So as Brother Glenn said, we kind of laid the foundation in the first talk there, and now we'll kind of be able to look into things a little better. So the first class is a little bit like learning a new language before we can read the book. And you know, hopefully now we've got the nuts and bolts of the Jewish calendar and of how the Passover feast worked laid out, we'll be able to do a little more, I think what I find at least, a little more interesting research into the things associated with it. Before I dive in, there's a couple of things I wanted to do that I kind of probably should have done in the last class. One is explain this calendar. The 14th, this is the calendar of the month Abib, or at least the portion associated with the Passover. The 14th there, you can see it's the one with the big P on it in red. That is the day of the Passover, the 14th of Abib. The next day, the 15th, it has a TS on it. Just to remind you, that was the travel Sabbath, or what I'm calling the travel Sabbath at least. It was the holy convocation of the 15th, the day in which they were each to return from Jerusalem to their homes. It's the day that the Israelites left Egypt and traveled to Sukkoth, from Ramses to Sukkoth. So I labeled it TS. That just stands for travel Sabbath. It's an easy way to remember that. Everything in blue is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You remember the Feast of Unleavened Bread started the evening of the Passover in the sense that they ate that Passover with unleavened bread. The week of unleavened bread is the 15th to the 21st. It was when they had no leaven in their houses and they ate no leaven. And then you'll see the 16th, the 23rd, and the 29th. I'm an S in parentheses. That's just your regular weekly Sabbath. Okay. Weekly Sabbath every seventh day of the week is where they rested from their work. And I don't have this laid out saying that the 14th was a Thursday on the first Passover. I'm not saying that. Just an example. So you can kind of put it in your head. Visual. The other thing that I wanted to say, thank you, Brother Pat. Pat had a good way of remembering the Jewish day. If you can remember the phrase, dark before the dawn. Dark before the dawn. That's how the Jewish day works. The Jewish day starts. Let's see if I can pull up one that has... there you go. Jewish day starts in the evening. And you go through the darkest part of the day before you get to the brightness. And that is really the way God has arranged things. We go through our probationary lives, the darkest days of our lives, before we see the glorious light of what God has in store for the righteous. The world sees its darkest days in the beginning, and after that, the light is revealed, the morning. So that's a good way to remember, dark before the dawn. All right, so in this talk, I'd really like to focus on what was actually done in the Passover and how that changed from the first Passover to the last. There's a few different periods in which the Passover was performed. The first was in Egypt, which we've talked about some. The next was in the wilderness. Between the time that they left Egypt, remember there were 40 years in the wilderness, so they commemorated during that 40 years. They weren't in the land. So the laws for in the land didn't apply there. It wasn't the first Passover either, though. So this is kind of a unique situation. After they're in the land, and specifically after God had chosen Jerusalem as the place that He chosen to put His name, there were special circumstances. And we've already talked about one of those, and that was that they traveled to Jerusalem before the Passover. They had the Passover in Jerusalem, and the next day they traveled back to their homes. And lastly is after the captivity. Actually, that should be after it was forgotten. I think that's correct in the next maps. But anyway, so you know, the children of Israel went into several stages of extreme wickedness where the law of God was forgotten, the temple was abandoned, and then the Passover was brought back by a righteous king. And that was the reinstitution. We learned a few things from those reinstitutions. You kind of find that the Passover morphed, not necessarily the laws of it changed, but the way it was... The way it was eaten within those laws changed a bit. Okay, so we looked at that Passover in Egypt a little earlier, but we'll just take another look fairly quickly. Just to kind of get the context of the situation. You know, I always like to study something out and get the facts of it and then go back and go through the situation and make it real for you. You know the facts now. You know how it worked. Go back and make it real. Okay, put yourself in that situation. So we'll do that a little bit here. So kind of put ourselves in the situation. Israel, remember, they're in Egypt. They've been slaves for quite some time. The only reason Moses is alive is because his parents disobeyed the law to kill all the male babies. Remember, so Israel is in a desperate situation here, in slavery to a stubborn Pharaoh. The plagues at this point, the point of the Passover, have all but destroyed Egypt, and many of the Egyptians are now wanting Israel to leave, but Pharaoh will not. Presumably, the taskmasters have backed off a little at this point because they are in a pretty tough situation. They felt the plagues themselves. And in this precarious situation, Moses gives the Israelite slaves a very specific law. It is the law of the Passover. And he begins it by saying, this is to be the first month. In effect, he was saying that this was the first month of their national existence and that this feast would commemorate that beginning. Unlike the other plagues, where Israel did little or nothing to prepare and God shielded them from the plagues, God expected something of the Israelites this time. They had very specific duties to perform to escape the destroying hand of the angel. Neglect of these duties would bring the destroying angel into the house of even the Israelites. Despite their long history of slavery and abuse in Egypt, they were each commanded to take a perfect lamb and kill it. Their poverty at this point was not an acceptable excuse for disobeying. The terrible plagues that had just wiped out Egypt's crops for at least the next year was not an excuse to disobey. It did not matter the situation. Each family or group of small families was to kill a ceremonially perfect lamb. It was not to be done spontaneously or haphazardly, but with much thought and preparation. They were to choose the lamb on the 10th, over half a week before it would actually be killed, and keep it close to them, pinned up. For many, this would mean keeping the lamb right in their house or in a small courtyard attached to the house. For days, it would be a constant object of consideration, a household member even. It would be a constant reminder of the coming sacrifice, a sacrifice that alone could save from death. It would be a symbol of national hope for the Israelites too, building an expectation that their deliverance from slavery would come with the sacrifice of this lamb. That lamb was directly tied to their salvation from death, their deliverance from bondage, their birth as God's nation, their change from poor to rich, and their inheritance of the promised land. And yet it was so humble, so weak, so mild, so meek. Isaiah 53 picks up this. It says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. The character of that sacrificial lamb, spent 4 days in their homes, was meek and mild. It was not a raging, strong lion that would deliver Israel from Egyptian bondage, that would save them from death, but a dying lamb, a slain lamb. When the 14th came, the lamb was slain. It was a strange feast. The lamb that had become a part of the home was killed. Now, putting a blade to the throat of an animal is an action that affects a person. It makes an impact on him or her. Such was the case with each of the offerings. Each time an animal was slain and sacrificed, the person offering the animal was supposed to be moved by the action. It was designed to affect the offerer. This would be especially true when the animal being offered was one the family had grown close to. It would therefore be a sobering occasion to see the lamb killed. However, it was only on special occasions that a lamb was killed and prepared for a meal. Only at times that warranted a feast. Remember Gideon's meal for the angel that came to him. This was before Gideon realized he was an angel. He says, depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee, and bring forth my present, and set it before thee. And he said, I will tarry until thou come again. And Gideon went and made ready a kid, and unleavened cakes of ephah of flour. The flesh he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought it out unto him under the oak, and presented it. And it's striking how similar that is to the Passover feast. Killed a kid and made unleavened cakes, an ephah of flour. And also Manoah, Samson's father, makes a similar offer to the angel announcing Samson's birth. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "I pray thee, let us detain thee until we shall have made ready a kid for thee." So it was an honorary meal when you killed a kid. Kid of goats or sheep. Sorry, that just sounds bad. So there was also a realization that this night of the Passover was a very special occasion. You know, everyone knew when you're having this sort of a feast, it's a special occasion. So that there would have been a tinge of excitement that came with that, mixed with the sobering thought of the fact that it was that lamb that had been close to the family. Also, there was quite a specific way of preparing and eating this meal. Of course, this would have engaged the mind of each member of the house and added to their realization of the meal's importance. The blood from the lamb was poured out into a bowl as it was killed. And the bunch of hyssop gathered earlier would be fetched. The hyssop bunch, so hyssop is like a grass or weed. The hyssop bunch was then dipped in the bowl of blood and used to paint the sides and the top of the doorway. The whole evening would be dripping with expectation and anticipation. Now, Middle Eastern meals are usually eaten in a very relaxed manner. If you were to go to the Middle East, the household members come in from work. They take off their sandals. Now, notice each of these points. They take off their sandals and they wash their feet. They put off their girdle. Remember, we talked about the girdle is what they wrapped their loose clothes up in when they were working. They take their girdle off. They relax in their loose clothing. And they would eat. They didn't eat at a table sitting in chairs like we do. They would eat sitting on pillows on the floor around the meal. They'd recline over their food. They're kind of laying, sitting. Generally, they're very relaxed when they eat. You might compare it to our idea of breakfast in bed. When you have breakfast in bed, you're in your PJs, you know, you're laying instead of sitting in a chair, meal served. That's kind of the way a typical Middle Eastern meal is eaten. Tonight, though, on the Passover, there was none of this. The meal was eaten in haste, meaning they rushed the eating of it. They did not eat it barefoot and relaxed. They each ate it with their sandals on, their loose clothing tied up around their waist with their girdle, ready to work or to run. They even had their staff in their hand as they ate. It was not a meal in which they relaxed and were catered to. It was a meal that required work on the part of the eater. The lamb was roasted whole, head and all, over the fire, and it was specifically eaten with bitter herbs. And, of course, unleavened bread. Not a bone of the sacrificial animal was broken. None of it was carried out of the house, and no one eating it left the house until morning. Anything left after the meal was to be burned. It was also an anxious meal. Each person participating in the meal knew that if it was not done correctly, the firstborn of the house would be killed the following night. To each, their obedience meant the life or death of their son or their brother or him or herself. This meal involved an intense combination of feelings, and each for good reason. Sorrow, hope, expectation, anxiety, eagerness, joy, and dread. It captured the full range of human emotion. It was victory in sacrifice. It was hope from loss. It was careful work for freedom from slavery. God specifically stated that none were to leave the house until morning, and that anything left until morning was to be burned with fire. The next night would bring the destroying angel to each house in the land, where he would either pass over the blood-sprinkled door or enter to claim the life of the most honored family member. When Israel left the next morning, they left a land where death was everywhere present. Not a family in Egypt was spared. Each had at least one dead, and several had two or more. While they all scavenged for embalming material that would surely be in short supply now, they had also to go through the elaborate funeral rites of the dead Pharaoh-to-be. Remember, they built pyramids for the deaths of Pharaohs. Their elaborates were national and very elaborate. So they're trying to juggle the funeral rites for their own dead brother or father while honoring the death of Pharaoh's son, not to mention every other dead person in the land, juggling this with their own funeral rites and the problem of about a quarter of their livestock laying dead in the fields, waiting to be buried or rot. The whole nation was in the greatest of grief, not to mention absolute dread of the Hebrews at this point. The God of the Hebrews had touched every part of the land and every part of their houses. Now, in a night, he had taken the life of every firstborn in Egypt, both man and beast. Truly, Egypt was the picture of death and desperation. While the Israelites are led out, burdened with riches and full of hope, carrying the bones of Joseph to their promised land. Now here we might do well to pause again and iron out a wrinkle that you may have noticed. Let's go back to our calendar, figure out where all this goes. So let's focus on the days surrounding the 14th, and we'll separate them into day and night, or night and day, I should say. We know the 14th was the Passover. We also know that the 15th was the day of travel, the day the Israelites left Egypt. Numbers 33 is very specific on this. This leaves two possibilities for when the first Passover was eaten. There are a few clues which tell us which evening it was eaten, and it was definitely not the way I had originally thought. The two clues in the Exodus account are these. First, Exodus 12:8 states, "They shall eat the flesh in that night." Now, there was only one night that could be called the 14th. It was the night preceding the day of the 14th. This had to be the night if the meal were to take place on the 14th, as it specifically states, between the two evenings or sunsets of that day. Second clue, no one was to leave the house in which the lamb was eaten until morning. Now, the night the firstborn of Egypt are slain, Pharaoh immediately calls for Aaron and Moses and tells them to leave Egypt. If this were the same night in which the Passover was eaten, Aaron and Moses would not have been able to leave the house and come to Pharaoh, as it would have been a breach of the Passover law. No one could leave the house until morning. Like I said, before studying this out, I figured the Passover meal and the death of the firstborn happened in the same night. But I can't make it work. We know that the Israelites left on the 15th. Numbers 33:3. They departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. On the morrow after the Passover, the children of Israel went out. So we know it was the night preceding then, this night here, that the firstborn were slain. This night was not on the 14th. The previous night was the night of the 14th when the Passover was eaten. This makes sense. The Israelites were not told when in the night the angel would come. We're told after the fact that it came at midnight, but the Israelites were only told that the angel would come this night. The blood must therefore be on the doorpost when the night began. The lamb slain and eaten already, according to the law, and the remnant burned before morning. To place the two events in one night would have Aaron and Moses out of the house during the night, the lamb not burned until after the plague was effected and Israel was freed, and the Passover dates violated. The fact that it mentions no events during that day other than the lamb being consumed before that morning is not a contention that the day didn't exist. It was between the two evenings or sunsets of the 14th that the whole of the Passover ordinance was completed, from the slaying of the lamb to the full consumption thereof. The only way for this to be true is as we have it here. As we move on to look at the last Passover, we'll find it fits perfectly. All right, now I mentioned earlier there were four periods of the Passover that I wanted to look at. In Egypt, in the wilderness, in the land, and the last is after their years of wickedness. The original Passover was in Egypt. The next was the Passover while they were in the wilderness. Next, the Passover in the land, and finally, when it was reinstituted after the Israelites had long forgotten about it. We looked at the Passover in Egypt, which was the original Passover. Every Passover thereafter was a commemoration of that event. It was to remind Israel of that event. We read in Exodus 12, "You shall observe this thing for an ordinance to thee and to thy sons forever. And it shall come to pass when ye be come to the land which the Lord will give you, according as he hath promised, that ye shall keep this service. And it shall come to pass when your children shall say, What mean ye by the service? That ye shall say, It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And the people bowed the head and worshipped." Now, of course, a memorial is not exactly the same as the event it reminds you of. The yearly memorial was very similar to the original Passover, but of course, at this time it was done in the wilderness rather than in Egypt, in tents rather than in houses, and without the desperate chorus of screams in the night from the Egyptian families. The punishment for failure to comply with the original Passover feast was the death of the firstborn, while failure thereafter was that that person should be cut off from Israel. We read of the second Passover in Numbers 9. Starting at verse 1, "And the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the first month of the second year, after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, Let the children of Israel also keep the Passover at his appointed season. In the 14th day of this month at even, ye shall keep it in his appointed season. According to all the rites of it, and according to all the ceremonies thereof, shall ye keep it. And Moses spake unto the children of Israel that they should keep the Passover. And they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, at even, in the wilderness, or between the evenings, in the wilderness of Sinai, according to all that the Lord commanded Moses, so did the children of Israel. And note this, there were certain men who were defiled by the dead body of a man, that they could not keep the Passover on that day. And they came before Moses and before Aaron on that day, and those men said unto him, We are defiled by the dead body of a man. Wherefore are we kept back, that we may not offer an offering of the Lord in his appointed season among the children of Israel? Moses said unto them, Stand still, and I will hear what the Lord will command concerning you. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If a man of you or of your posterity shall be unclean by reason of a dead body, or be in a journey afar off, yet he shall keep the Passover unto the Lord, the 14th day of the second month. 14th day of the second month at even they shall keep it, and eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They shall leave none of it until morning, nor break any bone of it. According to all the ordinances of the Passover they shall keep it. But the man that is clean and is not in a journey, and forbeareth to keep the Passover, even the same soul shall be cut off from among his people, because he brought not the offering of the Lord in his appointed season. That man shall bear his sin. If a stranger shall sojourn among you and will keep the Passover unto the Lord, according to the ordinance of the Passover, and according to the manner thereof, so shall he do. You shall have one ordinance both for the stranger and for him that was born in the land. Just as an example of that, Caleb, one of the faithful spies, was not a born Israelite. He was actually a stranger that was adopted as an Israelite. So he would partake of the custom the same way that the Israelites did after his circumcision. All right, but the point here was that this description of the Passover allows a person to take the Passover in the second month, should they be accidentally unclean when it came in the first. This allowance was used by King Hezekiah when reinstating the Passover after Israel's abandonment thereof under evil kings. Now notice it says, You shall keep it in its appointed season according to all the rites of it and according to all the ceremonies thereof. That is, that second Passover was to be killed just as the first would have been. If you missed the first month and you had to do it in the second month, you do it 15th day of the second month, just as you would in the first month. Exactly the same. The lamb was still pinned up on the 10th, killed and eaten in haste with bitter herbs and unleavened bread at night on the 14th, the doorpost painted with blood, and all to remain within the house through that night. This is how the Passover memorial was kept through the wilderness wanderings by God's servants for 40 years, and it established the rule of memorial for later times. Now, after wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, Moses is ready to pass away, and he leaves Israel with his last words before they enter the land under Joshua. The book of Deuteronomy is those last words, and it reminds Israel of much of the law. Deuteronomy 16, which we read before the first class, Moses gives the commandment for how the Passover is to be kept after they enter the land. and after God chooses the place in the land to put his name. Jerusalem was later that chosen place. We can read that in 2 Kings. The command from Moses in Deuteronomy 16 is this: observe the month Abib and keep the Passover unto the Lord thy God. In the month of Abib, the Lord thy God brought thee forth out of Egypt by night. Thou shalt therefore sacrifice the Passover to the Lord thy God of the flock and the herd in the place which the Lord shall choose to place his name there. Thou shalt eat no leavened bread with it, same as before. 7 days shalt thou eat unleavened bread therewith, even the bread of affliction. That's 7 days of unleavened bread. For thou camest forth out of the land of Egypt in haste, that thou mayest remember the day when thou camest forth out of the land of Egypt all the days of thy life. And there shall be no leavened bread seen with thee in all thy coast 7 days. Neither shall there be anything of the flesh which thou sacrificest the first day at even remain all night until the morning. Thou mayest not sacrifice the Passover in any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, but at the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name there. There thou shalt sacrifice the Passover at even, or between the evenings, at the going down of the sun, at the season that thou camest forth out of Egypt. And thou shalt roast and eat it in the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt turn in the morning and go unto thy tents. So that's why we have the 15th called the Day of Travel, Holy Convocation Day of Travel, because it says in the morning, you'll turn and go to your tents. That was a new commandment. The Passover was still to be kept, the lamb still slain and eaten with unleavened bread, called here the bread of affliction. Like I said, it wasn't exactly a delicacy. It was raw bread. It was just wheat, ground wheat, and oil and water. That's all there is. However, now the Passover was to be taken in Jerusalem. No matter where in Israel you lived, there were three times in the year that every male was to make the trip to Jerusalem. This was one of those three times. Jerusalem would be absolutely full of Israelites that had come from throughout the whole country to that one city all on the same day to participate in this important feast. If you've seen news coverage of the whole world converging on a city for the Olympics, you get an idea of the scale of people that would be crowding into that city. Every inn and house and courtyard would be full of people who had come to sacrifice their lambs in Jerusalem. Before, both in Egypt and in the wilderness, everyone stayed at home. There was no travel to be done before the Passover. And in the wilderness, everyone stayed at home. There was no special travel to be done before the Passover. But now, in the land, all the nation traveled to Jerusalem in preparation for the feast. And on the morning of the 15th, after having the Passover, they each traveled back to their homes to fulfill the week of unleavened bread. Many people came early for the feast. If you wanted to spend more time in Jerusalem, you came early for the feast. No one stayed late, because it was by divine command that they travel back home on the holy day of the 15th. Now, this was a source of panic for the Pharisees and Sadducees at the time of Christ's betrayal, as we'll see later. This traveling day paralleled Israel's journey from Egypt towards the promised land the day following the Passover. We read in Numbers 33, "And Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord. And these are their journeys according to their goings out. They departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with an high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. For the Egyptians buried all their firstborn, which the Lord had smitten among them. Upon their gods also the Lord executed judgments, and the children of Israel removed from Ramses and pitched in Succoth." So once in the land in which Jerusalem chosen as the place of God's name, the Passover was to be performed there and travel back home to take place on the morning of the 15th. There is one more time to consider before we get to the last Passover. Israel, during the time of the judges, and especially during the reign of its kings following David and Solomon, often sank into very wicked times. During these times, the law of God was forgotten. The temple was either abandoned or it was used for false worship, and the Passover was neglected. So much so that twice it had to be studied out and reestablished by righteous kings. Josiah and Hezekiah both led Judah and even part of Israel to a renewed observance of this feast. We read of the Passover under Hezekiah, king of Judah, 2 Chronicles 30. This is after the division of the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes. But Hezekiah actually attempts to include the 10 tribes in the feast. It says, Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to keep the Passover unto the Lord God of Israel. For the king had taken counsel and his princes and all the congregation in Jerusalem to keep the Passover in the second month, for they could not keep it at that time because the priests had not sanctified themselves sufficiently, neither had the people gathered themselves together to Jerusalem. So he finds out about this right before the Passover is supposed to take place. So he decides, there's no way we're going to be able to do it in the first month, 15th day of the month. We'll postpone it to the second month, according to that rule that we read about there in the wilderness. We'll have it the second month. And he actually writes letters and invites any from Israel that are willing to participate in that Passover to come up to Jerusalem and do it according to the law. So the posts passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh, even unto Zebulun. But they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. Nevertheless, divers of Asher and Manasseh and of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. Also in Judah, the hand of God was to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of the Lord. And there assembled at Jerusalem much people to keep the feast of unleavened bread in the second month, a very great congregation. And they arose and took away the altars that were in Jerusalem, and all the altars for incense took they away and cast them into the brook Kidron. Then they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the second month. And the priests and the Levites were ashamed and sanctified themselves and brought in the burnt offerings into the house of the Lord. And they stood in their place after their manner, according to the law of Moses, the man of God. The priests sprinkled the blood which they received of the Levites, of the hand of the Levites. For there were many in the congregation that were not sanctified. Therefore, the Levites had the charge of killing the Passovers for everyone that was not clean, to sanctify them unto the Lord. For a multitude of the people, even many of Ephraim and Manasseh, Issachar and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, yet did they eat the Passover otherwise than it was written. But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, The good Lord pardon every one that prepareth his heart to seek God, the Lord God of his fathers, though he be not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary. And the Lord hearkened to Hezekiah and healed the people. It was at this time that the Levites were charged with killing the Passover for everyone that was not clean. It would appear that the practice of having the Levites kill the Passover lamb for Israelitish households became fairly common thereafter, up until Christ's time, although it wasn't commanded in the Passover law. The account in 2 Kings informs us of the Passover under Josiah. It was after the book of the law was found and given to Josiah. This passage gives us some more insight into the workings of the Passover under the kings. Let's look at 2 Chronicles 35. First two verses say, Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, and he set the priests in their charges and encouraged them to the service of the house of the Lord. Let's go down to verse 13. And they roasted the Passover with fire according to the ordinance, but the other holy offerings saw they in pots and in cauldrons and in pans, and divided them speedily among all the people. And afterwards they made ready for themselves and for the priests, because the priests, the sons of Aaron, were busied in offering the burnt offerings and the fat until night. Therefore the Levites prepared for themselves and for the priests, the sons of Aaron. And the singers, the sons of Asaph, were in their place, according to the commandment of David and Asaph, and Heman and Jeduthun, the king's seer. And the porters waited at every gate. They might not depart from their service, for their brethren, the Levites, prepared for them. So all the service of the Lord was prepared the same day to keep the Passover and to offer burnt offerings upon the altar of the Lord, according to the commandment of King Josiah. Now, at this Passover, and it says there was not a single Passover kept like it since the days of Samuel, the priests, the sons of Aaron, were so busy preparing the sacrifices correctly, and the singers and porters were doing their service so faithfully that they had no time even to prepare their own Passover meals. And so the Levites had to help them. They had to prepare for them, that all might be done before the setting of the sun, which began the Passover Sabbath, or holy day of the 15th. There is no record of the Passover having been kept this way before. There were several There were several special sacrifices made on behalf of the nation on Passover, as well as during the week of unleavened bread, which kept the priests very busy, especially this time, as it was their first time in keeping the Passover in a long time. It would seem, as time went on, the priests were relied on more and more heavily to help with the inspection and killing of the Passover lambs, although, again, this was not necessarily commanded. Remember that the Passover law stated it was to be killed between the two evenings. King James Version reads in the evening, but the marginal note clarifies that in the Hebrew the phrase is between the two evenings. Now this we understand in light of the Hebrew day of the 14th beginning and ending with an evening. This was simply saying that the Passover was to be killed on the calendar day of the 14th. Now by the time of Christ, Josephus informs us that this phrase between the two evenings had been interpreted to mean the killing of the lamb on the afternoon of the 14th, between noon and dark. Apparently, it had become a tradition to have the Passover at this time, which should not surprise us, as at the time of Christ, traditions were very common that added to the requirements of the law and made its observance more specific. They would have eaten the Passover at this point, still within 14, and that was their interpretation of between the two evenings. Because later on they had what they called early afternoon, they would call that an evening, and then after the sun went down, before it became dark, they would call that an evening as well. And so they confined it to just that time period. So let's move into a consideration of the Last Passover. The Last Passover, which is the Last Supper, what we refer to as the Last Supper. It was the third year of Christ's ministry. He had many followers and many enemies. Many of his followers, unfortunately, were quite fickle. Days before the 14th, Jews began pouring into Jerusalem. The city would be solid crowds from end to end, and the roads into it full of travelers. It would likely be the biggest week of the year for sales of sacrifice-related items, and merchantmen would be competing for the best places of sale near the temple. Many people, no doubt, would travel to Jerusalem and buy all the necessary items, including their lamb, which meant they had to arrive before the 10th of the month. How fitting it is, then, that Christ would cleanse the temple at this time. As the merchants are jockeying for maximum profits during their busiest week of the year, Christ comes in and destroys the scene of commerce and greed and drives the businessmen from the temple. Christ as well had come to Jerusalem before the 14th and was staying in Bethany, only 2 miles away with Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. He would make the daily walk into Jerusalem to preach and prepare for the last Passover. The last Passover was the one in which he was to participate in a way no one had before, to participate in it in a way that filled it full. It was on this daily walk to Jerusalem that Jesus cursed the fig tree for having no fruit, a fitting symbol of a nation that did an amazing job of looking righteous, but brought forth no real fruit. To the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herodians, this week was an important one, but for the wrong reasons. They all wanted Christ dead. He was often roaming through Galilee, or in the mountains, or in remote areas, where it would be hard to form a plan and have him arrested and crucified. However, during the Passover, he was sure to be in Jerusalem, as the law required. He was an Israelite male, and therefore bound by law to be in Jerusalem for this feast. The city would be full of devout Jews at the height of their religious zeal, many of which would be easily thrown into a frenzy by a rumor from the religious leaders. It was a perfect time to have him accused and killed. But there was one problem, and that was the feast itself. There was so much to be done at this time. The Sadducees were the high priests. They had the duty of the offerings. Remember, they were the ones so busy on the Passover that the Levites had to prepare for them. The scribes, experts in the law, would no doubt be swarmed with questions concerning the feast and the sacrifices related to it. If the feasts were being honored correctly, the Pharisees, who mostly were scribes, And the Sadducees, all who were priests, would have no time for the arrest and trial of Jesus. The other part of this problem was if they didn't get it done before the Passover ended at sundown on the 14th, the next day was the Sabbath, where no work could be done except returning home. Holy convocation in which no servile work may be done. There could be no trial that day by the Sanhedrin. And Christ and the whole nation would be gone back to their homes, and the opportunity to have him killed would be gone. Remember, the day before a Sabbath or a high day was called a preparation. Preparation. It was the day where anything that would need to be tended to the next day was done, as no work could be performed on the Sabbath. Additionally, before the Passover Sabbath or holy day of the 15th, the preparation included, as we talked about, a large-scale cleaning of all the houses, as no leaven could be found in any dwelling throughout the week of unleavened bread. Also, the Passover had to be killed and eaten this day. So it was a big day. All of Israel was in Jerusalem preparing for the Passover meal, killing their lamb or kid, purging all their leaven, and making preparations for a day without any work, in which they must leave Jerusalem and travel home. At this last Passover, it actually happened that the 15th fell on a Friday, so that there were two consecutive days of no work to be prepared for. All day Friday in observance of the Passover Sabbath, and all day Saturday in observance of the regular weekly Sabbath. And all without electricity, running water, or refrigeration in a warm climate. Despite this, Christ's prosecutors spent nearly the entire day trying to force his death. Let's pause for a second, though. How do we know the 15th was a Friday? Now, without getting into all the debate surrounding this topic, let's just do a simple count. Christ rose the first day of the week. It's what we call Sunday, before the sun came up. We read that in Mark 16. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, had brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they came unto the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. They come to the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. They entered into the sepulchre, and they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And he said to them, "Be not affrighted. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him." So I think we can agree that he rose on what we call Sunday morning, before the sun was up. Now, we also know he was in the grave 3 days and three nights. Christ told us in Matthew 12:40 very specifically, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." They can't count Sunday because he was up before the sun. No puns intended. So that leaves the nights before Sunday, Saturday, and Friday. So these nights, 1, 2, 3. He was also in the grave 3 days. It says he will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. So let's count those also. What's the first day, or the last day, he was in the grave? Saturday night, because he wasn't in the grave Sunday, right? Saturday, because he wasn't in the grave Sunday. Go back another day is Friday. Another day is Thursday. Christ had been crucified on Thursday afternoon. He was in the grave those 3 days and those three nights. He was then crucified on the fifth day, which is what we call Thursday. Now, there's no foggy interpretation or fancy extrapolation. This is just simple math based on two plain statements. Now, I hope at this point we've established that Christ was the Passover. He was the meek and mild perfect sacrifice that freed us from bondage or slavery to sin. Paul expounds on this to the Romans. "Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are, to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness? But now, being made free from sin and become servants to God, ye have your fruit unto holiness and the end everlasting life. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord." So he freed us from our servitude, our bondage to sin. Also, we are born through baptism into Him as a nation for God, just as Israel was. Titus 2 says, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us that He might redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto Himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works. And just as Israel was by God under Moses, we read in Acts 4, we are saved from death by His sacrifice. Neither is there any salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. He was the great Passover Lamb, slain in the plan of God before the world was made. So if Christ was crucified on the fifth day, Thursday, that day was most assuredly the 14th, the day the Passover was to be killed. The whole of our dispensation hinged on the event of Christ's death. And I assure you that it fell on the day determined by God and displayed in the Passover feast for over 1,000 years before it happened. The 14th, then, was the Passover. The whole day was, and the lamb was to be slain between its two evenings. The 24-hour period in which the lamb was sacrificed started Wednesday night at sundown and ran till Thursday night at sundown. What brings confusion to most people is that this day is called the preparation, the day before the Sabbath. This is interpreted as a statement that it was on Friday. However, now that we understand the workings of the Passover week, it makes perfect sense. It was not the preparation for the weekly Sabbath, but for the special Sabbath of the 15th, the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And John makes this perfectly clear. John 19, verses 30 and 31. When Jesus, therefore, had received the vinegar, He said, "It is finished." And He bowed His head and gave up the spirit. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was an high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. It wasn't the preparation for a weekly Sabbath. That was a high day. Of course it was the preparation day. The day following the 14th is the 15th, a holy convocation with no work. The Passover day was always a preparation day because a Sabbath or holy day always followed it. 14th was the Passover. 15th was a Sabbath, a high or holy day, because it was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now back to our calendar. Since we know that the 14th was Thursday, we have a unique situation. This time they were preparing for a double Sabbath because the 15th was Friday, the Passover Sabbath or holy day, and the 16th was Saturday, which is a Sabbath every week. So once the sun set that Thursday night, there could be no work done except for traveling back home for 48 hours. So Wednesday night at sundown, the earliest observers of the feast would have killed their Passover. Wednesday night at sundown. You see, that starts the 14th. And even the procrastinators better have theirs killed by Thursday at sundown. All Passovers had to be killed within the 24 hours of the 14th. Thursday sundown began the Passover Sabbath, which ran through the night, the next morning, in which everyone returned home, and up until sunset Friday night, which began the regular Sabbath day that ran all night Friday and all day Saturday until sundown. Saturday night and Sunday, work could resume. Christ and the disciples, by the way, were in the early bird bunch. They had the Passover, which we know as the Last Supper, as early as possible. And it's no wonder He knew He would be crucified that day. So they had it Wednesday night, as early as possible under the law. We read about this in Matthew 26:20. Sunset on what we call Wednesday started the Passover day. Remember, sunset started the Passover day. Now, in light of the two Sabbaths, it is no wonder the Pharisees and Sadducees were absolutely beside themselves in desperation to have Christ crucified on the Passover. If they didn't get it done and over by sundown, the Passover Sabbath would be on, and they couldn't hold a trial or oversee a crucifixion, and everyone would go home the next morning, including Christ. And the next day was a regular Sabbath, so they still wouldn't be able to meet in trial. So despite the fact that even the average Israelite had a crammed full day on the 14th, and the Sadducees, that is the high priest, had even more to do, they were out all night for Jesus' arrest at the high priest's house before sunup to have him condemned, before the Sanhedrin, then before Pilate, then before Herod, then before Pilate again. That's five trials, by the way, they organized and executed in one morning. And they had him on the cross by about noon. The Jewish, by Jewish time, the sixth hour after sunrise. They'd made absolutely sure they could get him condemned and on the cross soon enough that he'd die and be taken down by sunset when the Passover Sabbath began. And that's what happened. They were even a little early. Luke 23, we read, verse 52, "This man went unto Pilate and begged the body of Jesus, and he took it down and wrapped it in linen, and laid it in a sepulchre that was hewn in stone, wherein never man before was laid. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on." So it's in the evening or in the afternoon. The Sabbath is about to start at sunset. "And the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulchre and how his body was laid. And they returned, prepared spices and ointments, and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment." The women still had time to prepare spices and ointments before sunset, but weren't able to anoint his body. The sun went down, beginning the Passover Sabbath. They rested the Passover Sabbath and the regular Sabbath, and that's why it was the third day before they returned, and he was already risen. All this is in accordance with his saying prior to death, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Remember how faithfully busy the priests were under Hezekiah and Josiah? They were working so furiously to do their Passover duties that they had to have the help of the Levites to prepare their own lambs. Now look at their descendants, the Sadducees. It is in stark contrast to the faithful service on that day under Josiah that we see the work of the Sadducees on the 14th of Abib when our Lord was crucified. They very well may have had their Levite brethren prepare for them, but it was by no means because they were busied about serving the Lord. Rather, it would have been because they were absolutely consumed with the all-important work of condemning and crucifying his Son. This they had found a way to justify within and among themselves. Somehow they had each been deceived by their own flesh into thinking that this work of slander and murder was higher service to God than doing the work he had given them in sincerity and single-heartedness. Don't be deceived. We've got the same flesh. It's not a deceiver we can point a finger at. It's right within us. If we follow Christ, we are delivered from the consequences of this flesh. But if we are lulled into complacency in that battle, we will be consumed by it just as the religious leaders of Christ's day were. And we crucify the Son of God afresh. And before we close, let's quickly review. Covered a lot of information. I hope you've learned a lot. But more importantly than learning a lot, I hope that this peek into how wonderful God's message is has inspired you to open your own Bible, put in some personal study time yourself. It's amazing what you can find. This book is absolutely full of incredible lessons and analogies, waiting to guide us through life, waiting to guide us in a practical manner. It holds the answers. All we have to do is ask the questions. The Passover was commemorative of the day of Israel's deliverance from Egypt, from slavery and from death, and their birth as God's people and beginning of their journey to the Promised Land. While it commemorated or looked back on this event, that event was but a shadow of the true deliverance from slavery to sin and death, and the opportunity for birth into the household of God and the beginning of a journey towards the Promised Land of the future, all through Christ, our Passover. We looked at the Hebrew calendar, which will be helpful in many other areas of Bible study as well. We looked at the workings of the Passover, the days that it included, and the feast that followed it, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which leads us into our next talk this afternoon over Christ's broken body. We looked at the development of the Passover feast through history down to the last true Passover, which Christ participated in by eating during the night of the 14th and fulfilled in his death during the day of the 14th. We also looked at the role of the nation, and especially the priests or Sadducees during that Passover feast. The only thing I think we didn't establish was that the Last Supper, when Christ started the memorial of the bread and wine, was indeed the last Passover. Up to that Last Supper, the Passover pointed forward to Christ. From that Last Supper on, the bread and the wine point back to Christ. That night, during that meal, the two feasts were married. That was the point at which they met. The one was fulfilled and the other began. We read on Sundays, "Then came the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover must be killed. And he sent..." "Then came the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover must be killed. And he sent Peter and John, saying, 'Go and prepare us the Passover that we may eat.' And they said unto him, 'Where wilt thou that we prepare?' And he said unto them, 'Behold, when ye are entered into the city, there shall a man meet you, bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house where he entereth in. You shall say unto the goodman of the house, The master saith unto thee, Where is the guest chamber, where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? He shall show you a large upper room furnished. There make ready.' They went and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And when the hour was come, he sat down, and the 12 apostles with him. And he said unto them, 'With desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say unto you, I will not any more eat thereof, until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God.' And he took the cup, and gave thanks, and said, 'Take this, and divide it among yourselves. For I say unto you, I will not drink of the fruit of this vine, until the kingdom of God shall come.' And he took bread, and gave thanks, and brake it, and gave unto them, saying, 'This is my body, which is given for you. This do in remembrance of me.' Likewise also the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you.'" We read also in Mark 14, "And the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover..." "And the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, 'Where wilt thou that we go and prepare, that thou mayest eat the Passover?' And he sendeth forth two of his disciples, and saith unto them, 'Go ye into the city, and there shall meet you a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him, and wheresoever he shall go in, say ye to the goodman of the house, The master saith, Where is the guest chamber, where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared. There make ready for us.' And his disciples went forth and came into the city, and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And in the evening he cometh with the 12, and they sat and did eat. Jesus said, 'Verily I say unto you, one of you which eateth with me shall betray me.'" This was the night that Jesus left us the memorial of his death. In it he tied together the law of Moses, which he was to fulfill, and the establishment of the law of grace, which we are under now, a token of which is the bread and wine from that Passover meal, now 2,000 years old. The exhortation, however, is as fresh and true today as it was then. "Purge out therefore the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast not with the old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth."